You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, George Brock from London City University and Nina Schick from the Open Europe think tank go through the day's biggest news stories and some of the smaller ones you might have missed too. Then we'll look at the rich and varied contribution Italy has made to the world of fashion. Get ready for luxury, extravagance and no little glamour.
By what I call the go-go years of Italian fashion in the 1980s, even designs that were designed in France were probably made in Italy. Such was the quality of Italian manufacturing.
Also ahead in the program...
Sono venuto a sparare a casa nostra. Dimmi una fotta addosso. La dai a pigliò.
Intriguing. We'll review the most interesting broadcasting from the world's television screens with Peter White from Broadcast Magazine. All that, plus we'll check in with our man in Budapest and enjoy a spot of music too. All to come in this edition of Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to enjoy then in the next hour here on the programme. Before we begin, let's hear from Paul Osborne, who has the latest world news.
Leaders from African and European countries are meeting in Brussels, with the crisis in the Central African Republic at the top of the agenda. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has said a strong international response is urgently needed. Officials in the country have said that tens of thousands of Muslims are at risk as violence by Christian militias intensifies. The UN is trying to evacuate 20,000 from the capital, Bangui. Ukraine's deposed president has described Russia's annexation of Crimea as a tragedy. In an interview, Viktor Yanukovych said he hoped the territory would one day become part of Ukraine once again. Meanwhile, a senior NATO commander has warned Russian forces could seize huge areas of Ukraine within 5 days. It's thought 40,000 troops amassed on the Ukrainian border. NATO Secretary-General Anders Fogh Rasmussen is warning Moscow not to make any further moves into Ukrainian territory.
If Russia were to intervene further in Ukraine, I wouldn't hesitate to call it an historic mistake. That would lead to further isolation, international isolation of Russia.
A 6.2 magnitude earthquake has hit Panama the day after an even stronger tremor hit Chile. Authorities there are searching for more than 250 inmates of a women's prison who escaped after the quake. It's known to have killed at least six people. Chile's president has arrived in the town of Iquique to assess the damage. The Taliban says it was behind a suicide bomb attack which killed six police officers in Afghanistan's capital. It happened outside a government building in Kabul days before the country's presidential election. Candidates vying to succeed Hamid Karzai have made their final appeals for support ahead of Saturday's vote. Fawaz Jejez from the London School of Economics warns Afghanistan's future is still not secure.
The Taliban are here to stay. In fact, we're going to see a very brutal battle and struggle in the next few months and next 2 years to decide the future of Afghanistan. The worst thing that could happen, basically, is all-out war in Afghanistan. The best scenario for Afghanistan is a political settlement.
Officials in Malaysia have warned the disappearance of flight MH370 may never be explained. The country's police chief says it's possible their investigation could go on and on. He's now ruled out all passengers as suspects in the plane's disappearance. Malaysia's Prime Minister is to meet officials in Perth who are leading the search for the plane. UN officials in Lebanon say the 1 millionth refugee from the civil war in Syria will cross into the country in the next 24 hours. That total is equivalent to one quarter of Lebanon's native population. The UN's refugee agency says it is struggling to provide help to those most in need. Nanette Kelly, who is the UNHCR's representative in Lebanon, warns it is getting harder to cope.
We endeavor to do our best. Right now we have close to 1 million refugees, and we are able to do a lot with the funding we receive, but we simply do not have enough. And right now our funding appeal is only 14% funded.
France's new prime minister has unveiled his new government and appointed the former partner of the president, François Hollande, to a key frontline job. Ségolène Royal will be the new energy and environment minister. Manuel Valls was made prime minister after Mr. Hollande's socialists suffered heavy defeats in local elections. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. And Paul will return with some world news headlines for you at the bottom of the hour. Right now, though, just ticking towards 6 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we'll be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London, 18.06, 13.06 in New York City. A very good afternoon to you if you're listening there. Joining me now here in Studio One with their take on the news of the day. Here in Studio One is Nina Schick of the Open Europe Think Tank and George Brock, Head of Journalism at City University right here in London. Now, welcome both to the programme. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little about the summit that commenced today in Brussels. EU and African leaders are meeting today and tomorrow to discuss trade and immigration and, most of all, the crisis in the Central African Republic. Nina, I'll start with you. We always look to these sorts of meetings of world leaders with great aspirations. How much hope do you think there is that these 15 European and 15 African leaders can actually come up with something tangible in this case? Because let's be fair, they've certainly got their work cut out.
Well, as you mentioned, one of the key topics of discussion is the conflict in the Central African Republic. And what the EU has agreed to do is send 1,000 troops over to help maintain the peace. So that's something that they're moving forward with. And I suppose, interestingly, from the EU angle, Germany has pledged support alongside France. They've been taking the leading role on this. And Germany has usually been very hesitant when it comes to foreign policy. So that's an interesting shift from the EU dynamic. Aside from that, they are also going to be discussing trade and investment. Now, this is a shift because the EU's relationship with Africa has traditionally been about development cooperation. And as Africa has become a much more attractive investment partner, now the shift is happening, especially as other powers such as China are looking towards Africa for its investment opportunities. So that's certainly a shift we're seeing. That's going to be developing more in the next few years.
I think that's really interesting, isn't it? There's this idea, and Herman Van Rompuy was talking about going away from development cooperation to this partnership of equals, which, as you said, normally means there's some cash in it for somebody somewhere. George, what do you make of that? Do you think that we are moving towards a partnership of equals, or do you think there is still a bit of a tendency or a temptation almost for the Europeans to look for opportunity, perhaps, in Africa rather than true partnership?
Well, I think that you've always got to be awfully careful when people in the EU are making very, very vague, nebulous statements about things. You've afterwards got to see what happens. And I don't think there's anything wrong with opportunities. If people have an investment opportunity, they make it. The problem is that it just hasn't occurred in lots of places. And the level of European investment doesn't seem likely to rise in Africa or anywhere else terribly soon. They just don't have as much to invest as the Chinese do, and the Chinese have made it a 20-year program. I mean, if there was something the EU could do to make private sector companies do that, then yes, it might be significant. I frankly rather doubt they do.
It's interesting you mentioned China then, but you've both sort of raised that spectre. Is it plausible, do you think, that China could sort of replace the EU as Africa's go-to sort of trading partner? Are we still politically maybe a generation or two away from that?
Well, certainly. And I guess a good analogy is to say that Africa has suddenly become the attractive young bride-to-be and has a lot of suitors. So Europe is not looking very attractive to Africa right now as a prospect. So although Europe has always been Africa's biggest trading partner traditionally, and certainly the biggest donor when it comes to aid, whether or not this transition can be made remains to be seen. And China will certainly be a factor.
Let's talk a little bit more about this specific meeting then. The people who are not there, because I always find that almost as interesting as the people who are. President Mugabe not attending, his wife denied a visa, various complications. Jacob Zuma has then, he's not attending in solidarity. What does this tell us, do you think? I mean, is it the usual suspects up to their usual tricks? Or do you think we should be alarmed that, you know, we still cannot get all of the key people around the table in one go?
Well, it's troublesome, isn't it? Because even with Mugabe, given his human rights record, it was, you know, symbolic that he was even allowed to attend this meeting. And certainly the president of Sudan isn't there because he's wanted by the ICC for crimes against humanity. So again, this brings up the problem of when you have a bloc as diverse as the EU or even Africa trying to find common ground is always going to be difficult.
George, what do you make of that? Do you think there's often it seems to be these serial offenders like Mugabe who, for a myriad reasons, I mean, Nina discusses the dreadful human rights record there, of course, chief amongst them. Should we be concerned about that, or is it this thing we have to be pragmatic when it comes to having these sorts of meetings? And if it means that one or two faces aren't there, then so be it. If we can get the discussion going,
I think that you may have to swallow your repulsion or pride or whatever if you can invite people to something useful. I would much rather the EU stop worrying about whether or not they should be shaking the hand of X or Y, and thought to themselves, might we employ our time better if we didn't try to pretend to be a state and we actually concentrated on doing some real problem solving. You know, we were talking about the Central African Republic just now, which is a country which is about as far from the question of kind of beneficial investment as you could imagine. It has no law, it has no police force, it has no coherent army, etc., etc. People are being killed all over the place. We probably don't know how many or where it's happening, even practically. It would be far better if the European leaders were sitting there, possibly not necessarily with African leaders present, unless they can help them, saying, how do we do something that is genuinely different? You know, there's no shortage of big tables around which largely men, not very many women usually, can sit in suits and discuss this stuff. That's the easy bit to do. The really hard bit is to say we can make an original contribution to a problem.
And what will those original solutions in this case perhaps look like? We alluded to some certain sort of boots on the ground we may see. There's other forces already involved with enjoying fairly limited success, it must be said, in the Central African Republic. Do we just dismiss out of hand the idea that something really meaningful that could help the situation on the ground could come from this meeting? Or do you think perhaps somebody may come up with a bit of a lightning bolt moment and say, actually, we can do something different this time around?
Well, certainly the fact that Germany has already committed to send forces is a departure from its former position. So the EU has gone further there than it has traditionally in the past, which is an interesting development. And they will continue to also give more money. But as to going further than that, I doubt it, to be honest with you.
The same doubts that we've seen before, unfortunately, raise their heads. Let's leave Africa now and that meeting and move east to Eastern Europe, the latest in the standoff, of course, between Russia and the West. NATO has announced that it's suspending all practical civilian and military cooperation with Russia because of the annexation of Crimea. Poland has called for NATO troop deployments. Donald Tusk, Poland's prime minister, says that Poland wants to be defended by the military, not only by words written in a treaty, the implication being that they don't really count for that much. George, understandable, isn't it? Is one of the problems with dealing with this situation, and particularly the response of certainly these countries in Eastern Europe and these states, that they have a very different historical experience and they have very different imperatives governing what they want to see happen next?
If you sit in England and you're thinking about this issue, you're in a dilemma. I'm completely sympathetic to people who are nervous about Russia and who have very good historical reasons for being nervous. And it is very difficult for people who sit in a country which has not been invaded for a very long time, as Britain hasn't, to sit and say, oh, you should relax and you shouldn't worry. But the fact is that I think the situation really is calming down. And I think an awful lot of what people are talking about is left over from kind of 2 or 3 weeks ago. Putin has already racked up what may turn out to be, in his domestic terms inside Russia, his biggest foreign policy success so far. You know, there were people in tears in the parliament. They stood to applaud him. His ratings jumped 15%. You know, that score's fairly large on the scale. He's got Crimea. Nobody is going to try and take it away from him. Let's face the fact. All that the Western powers can now try to do is to talk the situation into not getting any worse or nobody doing anything stupid. And moving troops around probably would at this point be rather foolish, because essentially I think Russia's actions in this whole sphere have been relatively defensive in their near abroad. And the fact is, in realpolitik terms, there's very little we can do, providing they are confined to the near abroad. Mm. Obviously, if they cross the border of a Baltic Republic in NATO or Poland also in NATO, that's a completely different game.
And I sense that your anticipation would be, therefore, that we should... It's sort of almost incorrect to fear that eventuality. Do you think that... Is that because you feel that Putin, what, is more of a political pragmatist, or you just don't think he'd push his luck? He's sensible enough to know when to draw a line.
Well, look at the two incidents in which he has actually taken territory, if you see what I mean. In Georgia, he baited an extremely clever trap, which the Georgian president proceeded to fall into by acting first, thus giving the Russians the opportunity to take a limited piece of territory, which they did. They shouldn't have done it, but they did it. Likewise, in the Crimea, they did not, you know, start invading the Ukraine in general. They, in a rather unmilitary way, almost without firing anything, seized the one piece of territory which they were almost certain were decisively theirs ethnically, if you see what I mean, which is the Crimea. So it seems to me it's bad, but it's quite careful and it's quite carefully judged. And that leads me to think, while I completely understand the fears in Poland and the Baltic Republics, actually that the system is, right now, in the process of cooling down, not heating up.
Nini, you're sort of nodding there. Do you go along with that analysis? Or do you think, I mean, it's interesting, certain countries, obviously the Poles looking for something much more aggressive in terms of reaction. Interesting rhetoric even from the likes of Finland, where, you know, support for growing NATO now is rising at a rate we haven't seen for a number of years. That's understandable, but you'd probably share George's basic confidence that,
yes,
that may be the end of it for now, at least.
Yes. I mean, Putin isn't stupid. He played this very carefully. And when this first started escalating, I mean, the EU said, if you annex Crimea, that will be our cue to take further action. And what they did was just, they put visa bans on several Russian people and visa freezes and asset bans. And they hadn't gone further than that. And they won't be able to, because we're talking about a block of 28 very different countries who have historical, economic and political ties to Russia. There are countries, including in the Baltics, that are 100% dependent on Russia for their energy needs. So further economic sanctions are unlikely. And I think Putin calculated that. Now, I think where we would see a further escalation is if Putin moved troops further into eastern Ukraine, then there might be some kind of further economic sanctions, but actual military action would only happen if one of the NATO states were invaded, which I don't think Putin would be willing to do.
It's unlikely. I just wonder, in broad terms, we often say, you know, oh, the reaction from, you know, the EU bloc, or we talk about NATO, various these institutions, and we're often surprised if there's not an immediately a very coherent reaction from all the different constituent parts. Do you think we're unrealistic in holding that expectation, that you'll get that kind of considered shared view? There's too much different history. There's too many different imperatives at play.
Absolutely. I mean, there is no EU foreign policy. You know, we're talking, as I mentioned, 28 very different countries. Some of the big players like Germany have been very hesitant to take a hard line on Russia because they have played this mediating role traditionally between East and West. And they just don't think it would be the most realistic political solution in the end. So they're hoping for a diplomatic kind of avenue to solve this crisis. But Crimea, for certain, is gone for now. That's for sure.
And George, just on that point about the sort of cohesiveness or not of these groups of nations, why do you think there's still that tendency? We still anticipate a collective, you know, coherent collective response. Is it sort of an example of collective political naivety from us all that we should expect that?
I don't think it's naivety. I think it's the habits of the past. We're thinking in Cold War terms. These blocs really moved as blocs at that point because they had absolutely no other choice. Now interests are much more divergent. And the other thing you mustn't forget is that this is not just a matter of the governments, but in a number of very significant places, by far the most significant being America, the electorate is becoming very, very wary of foreign entanglement. Don't forget those votes, both in the British Parliament and in America, about Syria. That was a very, very significant signal. That said to those governments, excuse me, you think you have our approval for this kind of adventure? You absolutely don't. That's a big change of atmosphere.
Those are the insights of George Brock and Nina Schick with us as well. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Tom Edwards. When we return after a short break, we'll discuss the rise of some centre-left politicians in Europe and an archive of voices of the popes. Oh, yes, it's going to be published by the Vatican. Find out more. Stay tuned.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 18:21 here in London. Still with me in the studio are both Nina Schick and George Brock. We turn now to look at the centre-left in Europe, something of a good few weeks and months. Just a month and a half ago, Matteo Renzi became the Prime Minister in Italy, and now Manuel Valls, the reformist centre-left moderate, has been named his counterpart in France. Intriguing developments. Nina, if I turn to you first of all, is this just a coincidence, or do you think there's perhaps a broader trend that spells good news for, you know, candidates in this sort of area of the political spectrum at the moment?
Well, there's certainly some comparisons that can be drawn between the two. First of all, I would say that they are both social democrats, not socialists. So even though they are on the left side of the political spectrum, they are, compared to some of their compatriots in their own parties, fairly right. Both of them have been chosen as prime ministers in countries with troubled economies because they're seen as drivers of reform. Some of the reforms that certainly Brussels has been saying that both Italy and France needs to make their economies more competitive and successful. We're talking about labour market reforms, making things more flexible, the kind of things that business likes to hear. So in terms of, if you're talking about a left party, this isn't the traditional rhetoric we would associate with them. However, given that they are fairly on the right within their parties, this means that it may be difficult for them to actually achieve those reforms which they'd like to see, to actually drive them through their parliaments. So those are the kind of three comparisons we can make between them.
Intriguing stuff. I mean, George, what do you think about this? Because we've discussed on this programme and others on Monocle 24 about the tendency, particularly in straitened economic times, of people to tend to look to, often to the right of their domestic political spectrum for solutions at the ballot box. Do you think this is a sort of an encouraging counter-reaction to that? Or what's your take? Do you just think that desperate times, particularly economically, drive people in all sorts of different political directions?
I honestly think they do drive people in more directions. The floor of Europe is littered with the corpses of politicians who have been, in one way or another, brought down by very difficult economic circumstances. I mean, these are not enviable tasks these people have taken on. And I think they are young hopefuls who look good on television, and now they get tested in trying to discover whether they can actually do anything. I mean, they're clearly electable. They're clearly attractive. Their parties are excited by them. They can kind of mobilise people a bit more than the older generation. But frankly, I think these things so far in their careers are far more important than where they stand exactly on the spectrum. And now they're going to be tested by the size of the problems they've got. But they both come, young as they are, from their own political establishments. No big change of kind of selection process going on here. I mean, the event that I think is liable to occur in the next 5 to 10 years in Europe is you're going to get a politician in charge of a country who absolutely does not come from the cozy political establishment. Watch all those French politicians worrying about Marine Le Pen, who really does not come from that kind of world at all.
Oh, I mean, that's an interesting point. I wonder, Nina, in terms of the specific challenges that face both Renzi and Valls, how would you characterise them? Has one got an easier job, perhaps, or is it an unenviable task for both?
If we're talking in absolute terms, Valls still has majority in French Parliament. His party still has a majority, although after the last local elections where his party really suffered badly, we're literally talking about one or two seats. So in that sense, you could argue that it might be easier for him to push forward some of these economic reforms. However, as I already mentioned, his own party doesn't necessarily unite behind him. So it will be a difficult task for both of them. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not they're up for it. Even though they're both young, you should note that they have already quite established themselves in their careers before becoming respective prime ministers.
And just on that point that George made about this sort of a real left field candidate, or perhaps that's the wrong expression, given we're talking perhaps about people from the right, is that plausible? Maybe it might not be Marine Le Pen. Should we really fear one of these sorts of candidates enjoying not just success in midterm elections or even in municipal votes, but in a really serious, you know, ballot box success? Do you fear that could happen within that sort of time frame?
Absolutely. I mean, the European Parliament elections are coming up in May, and what you'll see is a rise of far-right and populist parties. And with Marine Le Pen, the French just had their local elections over the weekend, and she made considerable forays, which suggest she made considerable steps forward, which suggests that she's not just being seen as the voice of a protest party. She's actually been seen as a credible political force, which is, of course, very worrying to everybody.
Worrying indeed, George. I mean, do you have a feeling about where we might see this particular success? Is there a European country perhaps where you think, look, the conditions are right, the pressures perhaps on the entire political theatre are such that, you know, it's riper for a riper opportunity to exploit than elsewhere, perhaps?
Well, I suspect that we are fairly lucky not to have seen this kind of thing happen so far in Greece. And I suppose if I was going to single out countries where this is more likely to happen, it's more likely to happen in Italy or Spain than it is anywhere else. But what I think is even more likely, for the time being at least, is what we've just got is very volatile politics. Because what you've basically got is people are, their support for established parties is gradually draining away. In certain circumstances, they can be persuaded to vote for them and they will swing back to them. But basically, attachments, solid majorities behind established parties, that's what nobody can any longer be sure of. The rise of the far-right parties is only going to go a certain distance in most of these societies. But in some cases, particularly where you've got proportional representation systems and very small parties can hold the balance, that can be very disruptive.
But just on that point about the sort of, not protest vote exactly, but these populist successes at particularly in European votes, I'm intrigued in sort of mechanics of how a success there can transform into a true, one of these actual frightening triumphs, you know, in a general election, for example. You're not dubious that someone could actually deliver. I wonder particularly if in a less sort of significant role, you know, some of their political inadequacies might be exposed, perhaps. You think that someone could actually ride out that storm and go on to the sort of next level, if you will?
No, that does happen. It's not likely to happen here in Britain, but look at Nigel Farage. You know, he's now having a much tougher time because, simply, he's a much more prominent politician. He's exposed to scrutiny in a way that he wasn't before. And that will probably happen with some of the other politicians of the far right in Germany or the Netherlands or whatever, where one or two of these parties have risen. But I think we're just as likely to see the rise of a populist party which could come from either side of the spectrum, which will appear out of nowhere, because what all the evidence tends to suggest is that voters are waiting for somebody to catch their imagination and say, this is an unprecedented situation, it's an incredibly difficult problem, and here I've got a magic trick to solve it, whether or not the magic trick turns out to work or not.
Well, I was going to say, Nino, just on that point, do you think that people are actually so you know, lack interest in politics at such a fundamental level now that actually they're not really even waiting for this mystery candidate who may be an extremist? They're just completely disillusioned and actually they've lost faith with the whole system altogether. Or do you think they are still persuadable if a credible and compelling candidate arrives?
Well, I think certainly that's disillusionment with the political establishment is a huge problem. I think in Britain, at least, our politicians are least trusted along with bankers and estate agents. So, yes, that's that's a huge problem. And it's one that politicians are constantly scratching their head, trying to figure out how can we, you know, persuade the public to try and engage them more. And one result of this is this rise, especially in Europe, coming on the heels of this long economic crisis we've been in, the rise of protest parties. And the interesting thing in the case of France is that Marine Le Pen's party seems to have made that shift from protest party to actual credible political mainstream party.
Now, before I let you both go, I wanted to mention briefly the story from the Vatican, another institution that's wrestled with various PR difficulties over the years, I think it's safe to say. Voices of the Supreme Pontiffs from as early as 1884, apparently, will be able to be heard. They've digitised over 8,000 tapes from the Pontifical Archives of Vatican Radio, apparently. These voices will be made available soon. Just in brief, is this evidence that the Vatican is, you know, getting up to date and it's not such a fusty old institution as we feared, George? Or is it a good old-fashioned piece of PR?
Well, of course it's a piece of PR, but it's a really fascinating one. Who knew? Who knew that they had been recording them as far back as the 19th century? That's fantastic.
I didn't even realise they could do that.
What was it done on, wax or what?
Possibly, yeah.
There's absolutely nothing. However much it crackles, how odd their voices sound, there's absolutely nothing like a recording of that kind to give you a taste of the atmosphere. It's almost like a tiny little bit of time travel.
Bit of time travel, I like it. And do you share that view? I guess the question is, did they have a bit of PR rebuilding to do still anyway?
I looked a little bit into this, and you'd be surprised to know that the Vatican website is surprisingly sophisticated. I'm sure they have people doing a digital strategy for them. And with Vatican Radio broadcasting live around the world, different regions of the world, it's amazing, you know, how they are using means like this to strengthen their influence. Did you know that the Pope has a Twitter account? Almost 4 million followers as well, where he tweets religious sermons and little things like pray for me. So certainly I would say this is a great story, and I think that the Vatican is investing into its digital strategy.
Digital future for the Supreme Indeed. Pontiff. That's where we'll have to leave it. Nina Schick of Open Europe Think Tank and George Brock, Head of Journalism at City University. Thank you both very much indeed, as always, for joining us here on Midori House.
Thank you. Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty still ahead in the second half of today's programme. We'll check on the latest television from around the world, get the latest local discussion topics from Monocle's man in Budapest, and we'll look at the reasons behind the success of Italian fashion down the years. Before all of that, though, let's get the latest world news headlines from Paul Osborne.
NATO's Secretary General has warned Russia it would be an historic mistake for its troops to make further moves into Ukraine. And as Fur Rasmussen issued his warning after NATO's most senior commander said that Russian forces could seize huge parts of Ukraine in just 5 days. Leaders from African and European countries are meeting in Brussels, and the crisis in the Central African Republic is at the top of the agenda. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has said that a strong international response is urgently needed. Officials in the country have said that tens of thousands of Muslims are at risk as violence by Christian militias intensifies. A 6.2 magnitude earthquake has hit Panama the day after an even stronger tremor hit Chile. Authorities there are searching for more than 250 inmates of a women's prison who escaped after the quake, which is known to have killed at least six people. Officials in Malaysia have warned the disappearance of flight MH370 may never be explained. The country's police chief has said it's possible the investigation could go on and on, though he said he's now ruled out all of the passengers as suspects in the plane's disappearance. And France's new prime minister has appointed the former partner of the president, François Hollande, to a key frontline job. Ségolène Royal will be the new energy and environment minister in Manuel Valls' cabinet. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank Thank you very much indeed, Paul. Paul Osborne will return with a full bulletin of world news for you at the top of the hour. That's 1900 here in London. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House. It's 1434 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, we're touching down in Budapest to speak with our man there, Adam Labor. Adam, thanks for joining us as always. Welcome to Midori House. We were talking a little earlier about the rise of the right and inroads at the ballot box from far-right parties, potentially. Elections coming up where you are. Are we seeing the far-right jockeying for position there?
Definitely. The far-right Jobbik party has boosted its support, almost doubled it from around 6 or 7% last summer to 12 to 14% now, depending which kind of polls you're looking at. And one of the main reasons is, firstly, the collapse of the left in this country after a huge corruption scandal. And, or I should say alleged corruption scandal, because no one's been found guilty yet. But anyway, the left has collapsed, but the right is surging forward because Jobbik have tacked quite hard towards the center. They've dumped all their rhetoric against Romas and the Gypsy minority and also moved away from their kind of open anti-Semitism that we saw before and remodeled themselves as kind of the snazzy party of rebellious youth, kind of like UKIP on rollerblades.
And will that strategy be enough to convince people, or will the canny out there still say, well, hang on a minute, there's some less desirable elements that are still here despite this makeover?
Well, yes. I mean, it doesn't mean that they're going to win or even that they're going to come second, but it means they're building a solid base. And the concerning thing is that this solid base is among young people. They're targeting first-time voters. And they're targeting, you know, people in their in their late teens and 20s, university students. They're surprisingly popular. It's from a Western European perspective, it's quite surprising when you see their level of popularity among the young people here for the far right.
Intriguing. I just wondered, Adam, in terms of some other sort of intriguing political developments, there's been an incident of, I would say unfortunate timing, perhaps. Hungary signed this huge agreement with Russia, a credit agreement about upgrading its nuclear facilities. Question marks been raised there about the timing, or are people happy for this agreement to go ahead in broad terms?
Well, it depends who you ask. People who support the government think it's great and don't really ask too many questions. But the opposition is furious, firstly, because of the agreement itself. They think it's a really bad time to lock Hungary in to Russia. What Russia's going to do is going to fix part of the Paks nuclear power station and is going to lend Hungary 10 billion euros over 21 years to do that. So it's kind of a win-win for Russia. They get lots of work for their nuclear technicians, and they get lots of money, and they get a kind of foothold in the European Union, in a EU member state's energy supply. So there's a lot of concern about that, a lot of anger. Also, the way the government operates, I mean, the thing was just announced. It was just, hey, guess what? We're going to do this deal with Russia. There was no real discussion in Parliament. There was no public consultation. No, because the decision is a strategic decision to rely so much on nuclear power. And, you know, there's a Green Party in this country. Okay, they're not that powerful, but they are in Parliament. They have a voice. And it's, you know, the critics say it's just typical of the way the government operates. It does a deal behind the scenes, then announces it, says, hooray, look at us. But of course,
I just wondered, in terms of the sort of PM then, I mean, is this one of these things where the fruits of all of this, whether they're positive or negative, will be reaped, you know, many years from now, when he's long gone from the scene? So perhaps he doesn't care as long as it's politically expedient now.
Well, I think he thinks that he's going to be around, you know, on the scene, running the scene for many years to come. I mean, he's still quite young, Mr. Orban. So I think he's planning for a very long term. But the other thing is that it seems to have definitely affected Hungary's response to the crisis in Crimea. I mean, it was notable that as that was unfolding at first, we hardly heard anything from the government here about it. And then the Prime Minister, Mr. Orban, gave an interview to a newspaper here saying he was opposed to European Union sanctions against Russia about this. And now, of course, it's his right to say that, and we don't all have to, you know, bow down to everything that Brussels decrees. But he's definitely, there was a sense of breaking ranks, although finally now Hungary's kind of got on message. I'm guessing it's been told that, you know, if you're in the EU, this is our common position and you better get with it, boys. So they've done that now.
Now, all of these talks of political wrangles of one sort and another, Adam, make me feel rather peckish. And I gather good news for fans of the gourmand in Budapest, at least.
Yes, our third Michelin-starred restaurant, a place called Borokonyha, which means wine kitchen. It's a kind of upmarket, Hungarian, French-influenced bistro. I have to say I've been there myself. I found it a bit kind of bright and loud and clangy, but maybe you know, I'm just getting too old for these places. But it's definitely it's the third one, and it's a part of a wave of, you know, Hungarian gastronomy is really modernizing itself away from the old kind of style of deep-fried, fatty, you know, heavy food to, you know, some quite innovative cuisine we're seeing here. So definitely the city is becoming more of a centre for gourmands and gourmets.
Mm, indeed. And very, very briefly, Adam, if you were heading to Borokonyha, then what would you recommend? Is there a single dish that the intrepid explorer should sample there?
I couldn't recommend a single dish because I think the menu's changed since I've been there. But I would definitely recommend drinking a red wine from Szekszárd, which is a town in southern Hungary where they have very, very good red wine. It's got a great bouquet, nice body, but not too heavy, not too tanniny, and a nice kind of ting of fruit to it as well. So Szekszárd red, that's all you need to know.
Beautiful. Well, maybe time for a liquid lunch. Good plans indeed. The suggestion of Adam Labor, a Monocle's man in Budapest. Adam, thank you very much for joining us on the programme. Up next, we'll get a taster, appropriately, of an upcoming exhibition at London's V&A Museum. And at the same time, we'll look for reasons for the enduring success story of the Italian fashion houses. Stay tuned here on Midori House.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, 2041 in Doha, 1841 here in London. Now, when it comes to Italian fashion, what springs to mind? Glamour, of course, which is the very essence of a new exhibition at the V&A here in London, aptly titled The Glamour of Italian Fashion, 1945 to 2014. The exhibition opens this Saturday and will showcase the best fashion of the country that has, of course, amongst its leading designers, Giorgio Armani, Gianni Versace, Miuccia Prada, among many, many more. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco paid a visit and spoke to the curator, Sonnet Stanfill, to learn what exactly makes Italian fashion so fantastico.
I think the word glamour really does sum it up very nicely, because I think that you'll see as you go around the exhibition that everything from the 1950s evening gowns to even the Pucci beachwear and the Italian men's tailoring, they all have the sense of style and a kind of effortless nonchalance that really sums up Italian fashion.
And how would you compare Italian fashion with other major countries like France or even the United Kingdom in a way? How do Italians see fashion in a different way from those other countries?
I think one of the hallmarks of Italian fashion is the fact that Italy has long relied on its so-called productive districts, which are areas of specialisms, regional specialisms, that include things like silk production in Como, leather goods in Tuscany, wool in Biella. And that network of regional specialisms has really been the backbone of Italian fashion. Also, Italian factories are some of the best in the world, so that by what I call the go-go years of Italian fashion in the 1980s, even designs that were designed in France were probably made in Italy. Such was the quality of Italian manufacturing. So I think that those elements are some of the things that really kind of set Italy apart, in addition to the really large number of family businesses that Italy has. And we can think of so many examples, Missoni, Etro, a company like Prada that's been taken forward by the next generation. So there are these kind of hallmarks within the way that the Italian fashion industry does business that are quite unique to that country.
How long did it take for you to make this beautiful exhibition? It's funny because we didn't have like a proper exhibition on Italian fashion, maybe even in the world, I'm not talking only about London.
Yes. Well, there have been exhibitions before. There was a wonderful show at Palazzo Pitti in Florence talking about the Sala Bianca. There have been individual designer shows like Armani at the Guggenheim and the Prada Schiaparelli Conversations at the Met, and also an exhibition partly curated by Franco Sozzani on Italy's 150th anniversary. And those were all excellent efforts. But what we've tried to do this show is to do a really broad introduction to our visitor of the full sweep of 70 years of Italian fashion production, not just women's fashion, but also menswear, fashion accessories, fashion photography, to try to suggest a kind of 360-degree view of this really complex story.
And I have a question. I mean, we all know those iconic Italian designers, but what about new Italian design? Is it still quite relevant, do you think?
One of the things that Italy is criticized for today is its kind of so-called weak support of nurturing young talent. But I think that's perhaps an unfair criticism, because you have efforts like those of Franco Sozzani with Vogue Italia and Alta Roma promoting contests such as Who Is On Next, trying to source, identify, and nurture new designers. And we have one of the winners of that contest in this exhibition, Stella Jean, who's only been designing for a handful of seasons, but has recently received quite a bit of press attention and support. Also, someone like Fausto Puglisi, who was actually designing for the stage for a number of years, but only recently launched his own label. And his passionate dedication to Made in Italy means that everything that he produces, from the silk that he has printed in Como to the leather accessories from Tuscany, are sourced and produced in his country. And he's very, very passionate about that.
And finally, I just want to ask, I mean, can you describe some of the pieces that we can find here? For example, the pieces that from Hollywood in the 50s, where they came here to shoot films, and Brand Italy was very famous all around the world.
There's a couple of pieces from the early part of the exhibition that might be surprising. One is a Pucci beach ensemble, which features a really wild kind of Aztec-inspired print, but it shows, sort of suggests what's to come with Pucci. Another wonderful example is a dress that was worn by Audrey Hepburn in the film War and Peace. It was designed by the Roman couture house Gattinoni, which is still in operation today. And that dress, there's some wonderful film footage in the exhibition of her dancing in the dress in the film. And I think it gives the visitor a sense of what these couture houses were capable of at this time when so many Hollywood celebrities were shopping in Rome.
That was Sonnet Stanfill, curator of the V&A's exhibition, The Glamour of Italian Fashion, 1945 to 2014, which, of course, opens on Saturday. She was talking to our Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who I was talking to after that, after his trip, and I wanted him to set the scene for me. And he said the best way to do that would be musically. So he suggested this, an iconic Italian song. It's Marino Marini with Volare.
Nel blu, dipinto di blu, felice di stare lassù. Nel blu, dipinto di blu, felice di stare lassù.
Penso che un sogno così non ritorni mai più. Mi dipingevo le mani e la faccia di blu. D'improvviso venivo dal vento rapito e incominciavo a volare nel cielo infinito. Volare, oh, oh, cantare, oh, oh,
nel blu dipinto di blu, felice di stare lassù.
E volavo, volavo felice, più in alto del sole ed ancora più su. Mentre il mondo pian piano spariva lontano laggiù. Una musica dolce suonava soltanto per me.
Volare.
was Marino Marini with Nel Blu Dipinto di Blu, Volare, of course. Taking us to Italy, just as Fernando's report did a few moments earlier. You're listening to Midori House here on Monaco 24. We're ticking towards the top of the hour. But before the end of today's programme, we have plenty of time for our daily review segment. Today, we're talking television. And I'm delighted to say that joining me in the studio is Peter White, Senior International Reporter for Broadcast Magazine. Peter, welcome.
Thank you.
To the show.
Hey.
Been a busy day over at Broadcast, has it today? I
gather? Yeah. So Wednesday's our press day, so we've figured out what's been going on this week, and the magazine comes out on a Thursday.
And put it to bed. You look remarkably calm. I've seen some of the faces of the people here at Monocle on press day, and not always as relaxed as you.
Should see me an hour ago.
Where should we start? Let's start with Gomorrah, perhaps, shall we? Sky Atlantic's offering. Tell us about this one, because people will maybe be familiar with sort of movies, books of the same name. Tell us about remind us about the series.
Yeah, so fascinating project. So Gomorrah is based on a book by a chap called Roberto Saviano. And it was turned into a movie a few years ago. And this is all about this sort of Italian crime organisation. And he's turned that movie and book into a television series, which has been produced in Italy and then has sold around the world. And most recently was picked up by Sky for Sky Atlantic, which was the first time that they've bought a foreign language drama. So sort of based on the success of BBC4's The Killing and The Bridge and shows like that. So they've sort of put their hand in for this. And it's a remarkable show. It's really violent, it's quite edgy, and it sort of takes that story on. In fact, Saviano himself, I think, is in hiding as a result of both the book and the subsequent show and movie because of how he sort of portrayed this family. That'll launch on Sky Atlantic soon. And it looks like a really great project.
Now, I guess some people, their first worry would be, well, hang on, look, this was a very taut and well-written and well-constructed book. It was then an incredibly taut and superbly executed movie. Are they just stringing this out? Are they just trying to cash in? I mean, that's maybe an understandable concern, but perhaps not well founded, perhaps.
Yeah, quite possibly they are looking to cash in, but actually done it in quite a good way. So the TV series takes on from where the movie finished, and so there is enough in there. I think that they have enough story. As you can imagine, the mob in Italy is very rich for fascinating stories. So there's an element of these spin-offs. We always joke, you know, when someone's spinning off a book or a movie in that way. But I think in this case, it's one of the few that seems deserved.
And just briefly on that point of Sky Atlantic optioning this, as you said, foreign language, it is interesting. You get that slight feeling that, you know, almost anything coming out of continental Europe at the moment, they say, look, this is going to be the next Killing because it's, you know, it's got subtitles. Again, is that just a cynical reading? Because there's a lot of great TV that's coming from there.
There is, and I think that's only been the case in the last few years. I think, you know, the joke being now that Italy is the new Israel with Homeland and Prisoners of War, and Israel was the new Scandinavia with those shows. Channel 4 just picked up a Norwegian political drama called Mammon. So there is still great stuff coming out of Europe. I think the difference is that English language audiences, particularly in the UK, and the US have just started to sort of be friendly with subtitles. I think that's the difference. I think we sort of don't mind reading while we watch at the moment.
It was going to work eventually.
Exactly.
It just required time. Let's go to Germany then, talking about the European broadcasters. It's interesting that Germany's public broadcaster has bought in this international series, again, foreign language series, for prime time. Tell us what they've optioned,
yeah,
and perhaps
so
why you think they may have done
exactly.
It.
Exactly. So ARD in Germany is the equivalent of the BBC over here, although they have a slightly different structure. But they've bought the BBC Three comedy Cuckoo, which Greg Daniels and such over here. And it's interesting that they've done that because they don't buy a lot of shows for primetime. You can imagine that in the same way as the BBC doesn't air much that isn't made by them or for them. It's interesting that this is the first thing they bought in around 10 years, which I think the last one that we could tell was The Office. So interesting that they've picked up Cuckoo. It's a neat comedy. It's quite younger skewing, which I think was one of the reasons they liked it. And it's got a star in Andy Samberg in the first series, you know, big American name. So that's just curious that it's sort of going the other way. I think we've been writing a lot about the UK channels taking foreign language stuff, so it's interesting to see that European networks are starting to do the other thing, other way around.
Everyone's thinking big in the quest for ratings. We shouldn't be surprised, perhaps. Let's look to the Middle East. This is intriguing. Killer karaoke. Now, perhaps people will probably jump to conclusions, rightly or wrongly, just from the name. It's a talent format. Well, maybe just remind us a bit about it before you talk about its transition to the Middle
East. It's an absolutely hilarious show. It was based on a karaoke format, and the Americans wanted to make it a bit more dangerous. So essentially what it is you have people singing, but while they're doing various challenges. So in one of the challenges, they're being attacked by guard dogs. In another, they're being filled in a pit of maggots. And they've still got to carry on singing. So, you know, if they stop, then they lose. And if they, you know, if they don't, they go through to the next phase. And it's been a huge success on a small channel in the States called True TV. And the curious thing here is that these types of shows, you know, tend to stay in their local markets. You don't tend to hear of these types of things traveling. But a whole bunch of channels in the Middle East have decided to make their own versions, including, you know, right from Egypt, where you might expect it because it's a slightly larger TV market, to places like Kazakhstan, which is making their own killer karaoke. So I'd love to know what the equivalent of a pond full of maggots is in Kazakhstan.
Well, let's take a very short listen. We've got a clip of this is what the US version was like. So maybe our listeners can then hear that and imagine how it may or may not translate. Let's take a listen.
Remember the first rule of killer karaoke. Whatever happens, do not stop singing.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
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 Performing the country hit, Redneck Woman. Let's hear it for Natasha Pagouni.
I kind of feel like that almost works better on radio even than on TV where you can see the pictures. That's Steve-O, I think, doing the introducing.
Exactly, from Jackass.
Can I just say, I cannot really imagine that in those markets you described.
No.
Are you more confident?
Neither could I until last week when I found out about them. So, no, we'll see. It'd be very, really interesting to see what they actually make of it. We'll see soon enough.
Exactly. That's going to be fun finding out. Let's talk... we'll come back to a sort of a local TV story here in London. We were sort of watching in the office, and I used to work at the Independent newspaper, and the guys who own and run that have launched London Live, dedicated TV station for the capital. The first question always on this: Did you tune in on opening day, and what did you make of the opening salvos?
I did. I watched a bit. It's very interesting, I guess. What we've tried to avoid the comparisons with live TV, if you remember that from back in the day.
I remember.
There's no news bunny or sort of topless darts, but it's a really interesting channel. It's the first big channel to launch in sort of terrestrial terms in free to air. You don't have to pay for since Channel 5. It's a very small budget, so the things that they do have are things like live stand-up comedy. They've got a show with Alex Zane, and they've got sort of a food show where they're taking street food vendors around London. It's nice that there is a London channel. I think that they had a few teething problems in the first day of broadcast, but it's a really exciting opportunity for younger people. They're targeting both younger audiences, but also people making shows that perhaps were doing that online and making stuff in their bedrooms, and then they're saying, hey, look, we've got a slightly bigger platform for you, where these people wouldn't have had the opportunity to do that on the BBC or Channel 4. So yeah, no, it's exciting. It's an exciting development.
Very, very briefly, Peter, maybe in a word or two, I was aware of one or two of those teething problems as well, I think, putting it politely. Do you think they've got the flair and the flamboyance and the resources to make this work, or do you think it's an opportunity that maybe might have to fall on the second or third person in line to really carry it off?
No, I think they will. I think Lebedev will have seen what's happened, and he'll be really wanting to make this a success. So I think they will. And they've got some people who make a lot of TV behind them, so I think they will.
Fantastic stuff. Those are the thoughts of Peter White, a senior international reporter for Broadcast Magazine. Thank you very much for being our TV reviewer guest today. And that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Special thanks to my guests Nina Schick, George Brock, and of course to Peter. Today's show was produced by Marco Sippi, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Janie Cho, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Next up after the headlines is The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. Stay tuned for that. 2200, of course, you've got The Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller. We'll be back with another edition of Midori House at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. For today, though, it's goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.